emulate their positive attributes and guard against their negative ones. We can learn from a child as well as from a famous celebrity. It is important not to be disillusioned when you find out your idols have clay feet. They can still be your teachers. You might even be able to learn more from obviously imperfect people than from those still pretending to be perfect. Does the fact that Mahatma Gandhi was not a great father to his children invalidate his message and example? Does the fact that a politician had an illicit affair invalidate the good work she has done? You can choose a priori to rule certain influences out of your life, or you can be inclusive and take the relevant lessons from each. I believe the latter course leads to a richer life experience. Cutting others down. I was part of a 10-person teaching team leading a week-long intensive workshop in the D school that we called Summer College. 5 members of the team were always present. The others came as needed. The participants were PhD and master's students from different departments at Stanford. It was a wonderful experience for all, and the students always gave it the highest possible ratings. Many said it was the best experience in their university careers. The students always commented on how they had never before seen such collegiality among faculty. They were inspired by the fact that 5 faculty members were always there with them, and that we clearly enjoyed being with each other. For many, it was a refreshing change from the world of backbiting and one-upmanship in which they were mired during their thesis research. Many students live in a world where people think they make themselves bigger by making their colleagues smaller. However, if you badmouth a colleague, you actually make yourself smaller, not larger. For example, if I tell you how wonderful the people I work with are, by association, you have to think I am pretty good too. On the other hand, if I tell you about my colleague's defects, by association, it makes me seem a little less admirable. Unfortunately, these dysfunctional attitudes are not limited to universities. They are fixtures in many families and in most organizations. Consider how it feels if every time you go for a haircut, the hairdresser spends the whole time telling you how bad all the other local hairdressers are. They don't know what they're doing. They fry people's hair. They charge too much. Eventually, you'll start to wonder why your hairdresser feels such a need to cut others down. Obviously, she's concerned about losing out to the competition, which may make you wonder if she has good reason to feel so threatened. For you to succeed, even to win a job or a promotion over someone else, does not require you cut down the other person. If anything, complimenting your rival shows class. Just work on yourself. Be concerned with your own strengths and qualifications, and don't worry about what your competitors are up to. Mentoring. A lot of fuss is made over the formal mentoring process, yet I'm not convinced it's very helpful. What I prefer instead are mini-mentorships. While working on this book, for instance, I asked everyone I knew who had published a book for advice. That way I had a whole team of advisors, each with a different experience and perspective to share. Don't be shy about doing this, provided you are open to the idea of doing the same for someone in return. You never know what you're going to learn or who will be helpful as you set out on a new pursuit. People can surprise you. Sometimes the ones you're sure are generous will be stingy with their advice because they fear competition, and the ones you least expect will come through for you in a big way. It's okay to ask for assistance. Look for people in your life who have accomplished things that you want to accomplish, and talk to them about how they did it and what they would do differently if they had to do it over. Get feedback from as many people as you can. You don't need to follow all or even most of it. Keep in mind that the more input you get, the more you have to sift through for gems. Good artists copy. Great artists steal. Steve Jobs often mentioned that he believed good artists copy, great artists steal, a quote he attributed to Pablo Picasso. There's no evidence that Picasso ever said that, but many people give him credit for it anyway. In 1920, T.S. Eliot wrote, "Immature poets imitate. Mature poets steal. Bad poets deface what they take, and good poets make it into something better, or at least something different. The truth is, there's very little new under the sun. As my colleague Larry Leifer says, all design is redesign. Everything you can think of has at least in part been thought of before, and it would be stupid to ignore the wisdom of the people who've preceded you. If you see good information and you don't use it, you're just being silly. Nobody can survive on his own. The fact that you know how to speak, how to read, how to add, it's all because you've taken someone else's idea and used it for your own needs. Society depends on building on other people's ideas. So, don't be too concerned about stealing. Of course, don't take credit for someone else's work or simply copy something outright without improving it or putting your own spin on it. Understand that it's okay to build off others' ideas, and don't be too possessive of your own. It's disturbing to realize that lives might have been saved if some researchers weren't so secretive and fixed on winning the race to a Nobel Prize. Some people are fiercely protective of their own data and ideas, often for years, until they can publish their work. The public good would be much better served if people worked more collaboratively. Commit yourself to radical collaboration. The curse of networking. If you read business books or take classes, you've undoubtedly been told about the power of networking, handing out your business card at social luncheons, showing up at key events, and promoting yourself. It's so smarmy and manipulative and usually pretty transparent. My best advice for you is not to network at all. If what you're really doing is trying to buddy up to people you think are on a higher plane than you are to get help from them, it's a lecherous relationship, and it's not genuine. There are expert networkers who succeed at whatever they're trying to promote. Even so, when I go to sleep at night, I'm glad I'm me and not them. I've heard several cautionary tales of people who've overstepped the privileges of acquaintance. Never pretend that you have a relationship with someone that goes beyond what's really there. An opportunistic person might say, "Joe Smith suggested I contact you," when in fact Joe Smith said no such thing. When this gets back to Joe, can you guess what he's going to say? Don't assume it's okay to use someone's name to get in the door, even if you consider that person a friend. Ask first, or it's likely to backfire. Life is not about using other people as you climb to the top. Stay real, instead, and build friendships. Too many people are afraid to mix their business lives with their personal lives, and I think that's sad. That came to me once when I was talking with Jean and Georges, who'd worked together for years, and I realized they barely knew anything about each other. They'd never been in each other's homes, and they didn't know anything about each other's spouses or children. What a waste. Don't be afraid of real human relationships. They matter. Some people have bad experiences working with their friends. Yet there are many examples of lifelong friend-work connections. My colleague David Kelly realized, when he was still a Stanford master's student, that it was fun to work with his friends. He formed a company called Intergalactic Design with several of his classmates. Three companies, and over 40 years later, some of the same friends are still working with him. It is common wisdom that if you lend money to your friends, you will lose both your money and your friendship. I guess that is the case if you have the wrong friends. I've always found it a great pleasure to assist friends to fund their projects or meet temporary needs, and I have never lost my money or my friendships. When you forge these kinds of real relationships, the word networking doesn't even come into play. You naturally think of each other when opportunities arise. You ask for assistance and they show up, because they are friends and that's what friends do. Not because you gave them a fake smile and a firm handshake at a luncheon. Let people see you as human. Be real. Ask yourself, who would you rather see at your door? A friend or a door-to-door salesman? Be proactive in making friendships wherever you land. Invite people out to eat or over to your house. When you hear that a loved one of theirs is sick, Follow up and ask about it the next day. Your turn. Do you have coworkers you don't know much about? Take time to get to know some of them. Make a few casual lunch or coffee dates, and take time to have a social conversation, not business or office gossip. Find out about their lives, and if they are interested, share information about yours. What it comes down to is that if you want people to assist you, you should A, ask them, because not everyone is that attuned to what you need, and B, be a decent human being. Don't pretend you know more than you do. Most people are flattered when you have a genuine need to ask for their expertise. When you're offered assistance, respect others' time constraints. Don't call every day or expect them to write responses to 100 questions. And be appreciative. Doing is everything. Chapter 5. For the things we have to learn before we can do them, we learn by doing them. Aristotle. Whenever anyone makes an important change, it's because a switch has flipped. Someone who has struggled her whole life with her weight finally decides to get fit. Someone who has put up with an abusive boss for years finally has enough and quits. Someone who has harbored a secret crush finally takes the plunge and asks her beloved out for coffee. A shift has happened that has made action favorable to inaction. You can sit around in the dark waiting for the light to come on, or you can get up, walk across the room, and flip the switch yourself. Trying and doing. As we've established, there is a big difference between trying to do something and actually doing it. They're two totally different actions. The difficulty arises when people conflate them. If you try to do something, it may or may not happen. If it doesn't happen, you might try using an alternate strategy. And again, it may not happen. Although this could go on indefinitely, usually it lasts until you luck out and succeed, get tired of trying, or get distracted by something else. Clearly, this is a very unproductive way to go about your life. If you are doing something, then no matter how many times you hit a barrier, or how frustrated your original strategy becomes, you intend to get the job done, and you bring to bear on it the inner resolve and attention necessary to fulfill your intention. Doing takes intention and attention. Remember the exercise I gave my students in which I asked one of them first to try to take an object from me, and then to actually take the object from me? Wrestling over the object when the volunteer is trying is often fun for both of us. Trying can often be fun and easy. Nevertheless, it is doing that gets things done. In 1974, I was having lunch with my friend Harold in the Russian Tea Room, a fashionable restaurant near Carnegie Hall in New York City. The waiters in this restaurant all wear Russian Cossack uniforms, which my friend admired because he was a big fan of the Soviet Union. The thought came to me, as he kept expressing this admiration, how wonderful it would be to get Harold one of these uniforms. Suddenly, I just decided I would do it. I didn't know how, yet whatever it took, I would give him one of these uniforms as a present. Taking advantage of Harold's legendary frugality, I told him that I would pay for the lunch if he would go get the car. I sized up all the waiters as soon as he left, choosing the one who looked most amenable to a beneficial economic transaction. I called that waiter to my table, told him how much we had enjoyed the lunch, and relayed Harold's great admiration for the uniform. I told him that if he could get me a uniform, I would make it worth his while. "How worthwhile?" he asked. I took out my wallet, opened it to the billfold section, and said, "You decide." He removed a $10 bill, which would be $50 in today's money, and left without another word. A short time later, I was waiting by the curb with a full uniform, including boots, wrapped in a day-old newspaper. Harold died in 2011, and I often think of him when I'm doing the trying versus doing demonstration. I recall that moment of triumph and the resulting flash of insight that I gained long ago. I am still warmed by recalling how happy and astounded Harold was when I gave him the uniform. Another time, I was leading a workshop for a professional group in Seoul, Korea. A young woman volunteered to do the trying versus doing exercise, and when I asked her to take the object from my hands, she immediately seized my eyeglasses and threatened to break them unless I gave her the object. I paid the ransom and retrieved my glasses unharmed. It was perhaps a bit scary, yet she certainly had a creative approach. This incident brings up the question of ethics and morality. Here's an extreme case. If I had to kill you to move from trying to doing, in normal circumstances, I would change my mind and decide not to do it. The exercise is about the difference between trying and doing. It is not about ethics or morality. You need to decide for yourself if you are going to violate any boundaries. If doing requires trespassing, then perhaps it is time to change your intention from doing to not doing. I don't know if the woman would have broken my glasses. Given her previous behavior, I think there is a good chance she would have carried out her threat. If she had broken them, I could have had a new pair made. In any case, her intention was strong enough to get her the object, and in my view, no strong ethical or moral boundaries were crossed. Recently, I had a family experience that beautifully illustrates the difference between trying and doing. My wife Ruth and I were in San Francisco for the evening. After dinner, driving past the Roxy, a neighborhood movie theater we occasionally frequent, I noticed a crowd and a program that sounded interesting to me. I suggested that Ruth should buy the tickets while I hunted for a parking place. She was lukewarm about the movie, yet agreed to the plan anyway. When I returned to the Roxy 10 minutes later, I was shocked to find that Ruth was not in line. She told me that she had tried to buy tickets, but they were sold out. Because I really wanted to go, I sprang into action. I went to the box office and asked the seller if there were any cancellations. She agreed to take my name, and I agreed to wait close by. Then I started to ask people in line if they had an extra ticket. I was able to purchase one ticket from someone approaching the box office for a refund, and another one from someone in the line whose friend had phoned to say she was not coming. Suddenly, we were doing. This incident illustrates some basic points. My wife didn't really want to go to the movie, and when they told her that the show was sold out, she had a good reason for not going. I was determined to go, so the fact that they were sold out was simply a lamppost I had to walk around. I knew the sold-out reason was bullshit. The moral? If you don't really want to do it, then the world might be nice enough to give you a good reason why it can't be done. If you really want to do it, those reasons are not going to stop you. Actually, in this case, we would have been much better off trying rather than doing. The movie and live show were terrible. As they say, be careful what you wish for. We can also apply the notion of trying and doing to a person rather than her actions. Instead of trying, you would see yourself as a trier. Instead of doing, you would see yourself as a doer. Unless you are an extreme type A personality, you will have a better life incorporating both trier and doer into your self-image and calling on each as appropriate. Come to think of it, maybe you should incorporate both, especially if you are type A. A little more trying and a little less doing might extend your lifespan. Affirmations, a tool for change? Maxwell Maltz was a cosmetic surgeon who found that his patients were often not satisfied with their surgery, even though it was technically successful. He believed this was in large measure due to the patients having unhealthy self-images. His solution was to develop a series of techniques with which he felt people could improve their self-images. One of his methods was to have a person set a series of goals and then picture achieving them with the aid of mental visualization techniques. Maltz relied on the power of self-affirmation and mental visualizations, as well as the connection between the mind and the body. In 1960, he published his idea in Psycho-Cybernetics, a straightforward self-help book that ultimately sold more than 30 million copies. A large industry and volumes of literature subsequently developed around the use of affirmations as a tool to change self-image. Several of my students found Maltz's affirmations exercises useful. An affirmation is a carefully formatted statement that you repeat frequently to yourself, and which can also be written down. People who perform affirmations contend that a positive mental attitude supported by affirmations will make almost anything possible. For an affirmation to be effective, they believe, it needs to be present tense, positive, personal, and specific. You pick something you want to change or reinforce, and take time each day to tell yourself that it has happened. To use an affirmation to improve your self-image, for example, you might repeat to yourself, "I am a loving person when I'm interacting with my daughter." Certainly, a positive mental attitude is a big plus in life. Affirmations work well for some people. However, they're not for everybody. I find it hard to convince myself that the positive stuff is really true. It reminds me of the part in the film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, where the Wicked Queen is daily asking the magic mirror, "Who is the fairest in the land?" Even though the queen gets the answer she wants, she does not seem to believe it. If she did, she wouldn't need to keep going back to the mirror to check. To me, the problem with the self-affirmation movement is that people often feel that positive affirmations seem false, yet they readily accept the negative self-images they carry around as true. It's a classic example of seeing a glass as half-empty or half-full. For many of us, the half-empty seems real, and the half-full seems false. Probably the glass is both half-full and half-empty, and we get to decide which way we see it. The idea is to get enough external verification of the half-full version that our self-image really changes. And we don't need to keep going back to the magic mirror in our heads to find out who and what we are. One way to do this is to use affirmations in a slightly indirect way. Instead of dealing directly with a desired accomplishment, we can use affirmations to modify a behavior such that the modified behavior leads indirectly to the desired accomplishment. For example, in one study, students with low academic self-esteem were not asked to think of themselves differently. Instead, they were simply asked to list and write about characteristics they felt were positive in regard to education and career preparation. These students ended up staying in school at much higher rates than those in a peer group. This is closely related to the advice parents and teachers are often given, to affirm their children's efforts rather than their accomplishments. The idea is that if affirmations are given, they should reinforce the desired characteristic, namely, the effort, which then endures and transcends any transitory failure. When reinforcement is based solely on accomplishment, it doesn't foster the resiliency that is needed to overcome life's inevitable disappointments. Just do it. When I started teaching the course on which some of this book is based, I knew that I wanted students to choose projects having to do with their own lives. Moreover, I had met a lot of engineers in Silicon Valley who worked for big companies, such as Hewlett-Packard, and had dreams of starting their own companies. This was back in the 1960s, before the availability of serious angel and venture funds or the strong culture of startups. People just talked about it, and nothing happened. The situation reminded me of the Eugene O'Neill play, The Iceman Cometh. The characters spend the entire play in a saloon talking about leaving, yet no one leaves. Nick, one of my acquaintances, actually left Hewlett-Packard and started his own company. I was so delighted that I bought him a case of champagne. Now, 40 years later, he is probably still wondering why I did it. This gave me the idea that students need to learn not to wait until after they graduate. Many students develop the idea that they're supposed to follow a prescribed path in which they're not allowed to achieve anything until after they get a diploma. And if they don't develop the habit of doing things of their own volition, they will not change after they graduate. Many of the greatest entrepreneurs already had their businesses going during college, and many never graduated. Today's clearest example is Mark Zuckerberg and four fellow students who started Facebook from the dorms at Harvard University. Based on this thought, I decided the class project directive would be, do something you have really wanted to do and have never done, or solve a problem in your life. The projects served to introduce the achievement habit. Students learned they did not need to wait for some future time to take command of their lives. Doing this 10-week project of their own choice gave them a sense of empowerment that in many cases carried over into the rest of their lives. You too can stop waiting for Godot and learn to do things that you have always wanted to do. If you start doing and also apply the ideas in this book toward ridding yourself of unwanted issues, the chances are good that you, too, will have a much more interesting and fulfilling life. Hugh Laurie, the doctor in the TV show House, said in an interview with the magazine Time Out New York, "It's a terrible thing, I think, in life to wait until you're ready. I have this feeling now that actually no one is ever ready to do anything. There's almost no such thing as ready. There's only now, and you may as well do it now. I mean, I say that confidently as if I'm about to go bungee jumping or something. I'm not. I'm not a crazed risk taker, but I do think that, generally speaking, now is as good a time as any." It's like riding a bike. A friend recently told me that she wanted to learn to ride a bike. She's a woman in her 30s, so I wondered why she had never learned as a child. What were the issues that had prevented her from learning thus far? My first assumption was that she must have lived in a busy city. "No, the suburbs," she said. "I tried to learn, but I have a terrible sense of balance. I never got it." It was a good time to check out problem solving through design thinking, so we went through the steps. First, I had to make sure she was solving the right problem. Did she really want to learn to ride a bike, or was there a higher level problem that she needed to solve? I asked her why she wanted to do this now. "My daughter just learned how to ride a bike, and she's good at it. Right now, I can just jog alongside her and keep up, but I won't be able to do that for long. I want to learn so I can ride with her." The problem one level up was that she wanted to be able to keep up with her daughter, and I had enough empathy to see it through her eyes. Working on bike riding seemed a good way to tackle it, so it was time to ideate. How could she learn to ride a bike? "I figured I'd just go to a bike shop and ask them for the easiest bike to ride," she said, and that was one possible solution. However, what if she encountered the same balance problems she had as a child? She indicated that she still got dizzy easily. We talked through a few ideas. She might take a yoga class to improve her balance. She might see a doctor to find out if she needed medication for an inner ear problem. She could take lessons, or she could put training wheels on an adult's bike. That one made her laugh, but fortunately it led to a more serious potential solution. "You know, there are three-wheelers for adults," I said. A light bulb went off. She hadn't considered that. Sure, they might look a little odd compared to sleeker road bikes, but it would solve her problem instantly, without the need to really learn to ride a bike. She could keep up with her daughter, which was the higher-level problem, and skip right over the balance problem. It's just what a friend of mine had done when her aging body had given up on regular biking and her mind had not. She felt so good about this solution that I didn't bother exploring other ways for her to keep up with her bike-riding daughter. This is the power of working with a partner or team. We each have different experiences and perspectives to lend. I was able to give her an instant solution to a problem she'd been putting off tackling because it seemed too difficult. It enabled her to stop thinking and start doing. Acting under pressure. Something we read in my class is "Tractoring Off," an excerpt from The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. It tells the story of a confrontation between a Dust Bowl farmer whose land has been foreclosed by the bank and a young tractor driver who was hired to plow the land, in the process destroying the farmer's house and farm. The tractor driver grew up in the neighborhood, and the farmer knows him and his father. After the class has read the story, I ask for a show of hands as to how many people would choose to drive the tractor if they had no better means of supporting their family. Then I ask how many would not drive the tractor, and how many aren't sure. I get about 45% on either side and about 10% undecided. This essay represents a classic moral issue. The tractor driver realizes that what he is doing is destructive to the farmer and the farmer's family, yet he feels he has little alternative if he is going to support his own family. Ultimately, he rationalizes his position by telling the farmer that if he does not do it, someone else is going to plow the land and destroy the farm. Even if the farmer shoots him, someone will come tomorrow and do the job. This rationalization and justification, "if I don't do it, someone else will," is very common. So is the variant, "I had to take care of my family," and the slightly less philosophical, "I was just following orders." I like this essay because it gives me a great opening to share with students my belief that they have no way of knowing what they will do when they are actually confronted with a comparable moral dilemma. I tell them that in moments of crisis in my own life, I have found that I did not always act in keeping with my self-image. Once, my wife Ruth and I were traveling around France by car. She was driving, and our younger son was in the back seat. We rounded a turn at the top of a hill and saw a line of cars stopped at a traffic light at the bottom. Ruth tried to slow the car down, and nothing happened. She shouted that the brakes were not working. After a moment of terror, I felt relaxed and comforted by the sense that at least all three of us would die together. Fortunately, the only one to die was the car, which was totaled. Neither my family nor the unfortunate French family we plowed into was injured. In fact, the French driver was very gracious. In spite of our having ruined the trailer that he was towing on the way to his family holiday, he suggested that because we could not do anything until the rental agency and the tow truck company reopened after their lunch break, we might as well all have lunch together. To my later embarrassment, I was much too upset to accept his generous act of civility. Shortly after the crash, I figured out what had happened. The car had a manual transmission, and Ruth, who was used to driving an automatic transmission, had mistakenly put her foot on the clutch rather than the brake. I felt really stupid. Instead of blissing out over our impending deaths, I should have reached my foot over and stepped on the brake, or told her to do it, or pulled up the emergency brake, or jammed the car into reverse, anything other than what I did. I am usually so clear-headed and action-prone in emergencies. What happened to me? This was not the Bernie I know. I had a similar experience when a good friend and colleague was being considered for a promotion. A question had arisen in the provost's office about his effectiveness as a classroom teacher. It fell to me to survey his current class. I was asked to have the students fill out rating forms. I did what I was asked and collected the completed forms. I looked over the forms in the privacy of my office, and I realized that a few of them would cause difficulty. The promotion would not go through if I sent them on to the provost's office. I hesitated. I knew my colleague was a good teacher, although his style was unorthodox, and not all students appreciated his creative approach. I also didn't believe the survey forms were a good measure of his teaching. Most of all, I thought of myself as being loyal to my colleague, and I certainly did not share many of the values the provost's staff used in judging people. With all these factors on the side of losing a few of the forms, my self-image at that time was that I would not turn them in. However, in the end, I did forward the entire package. I resolved my moral crisis by doing exactly what I was sure I would not do. Fortunately, this was not a matter of life or death. My friend was unhappy for a time. However, his promotion was delayed for only 1 year. He went on to a distinguished career, and he has lived, more or less, happily ever after. Although it can be interesting to read about another situation and pass judgment about how you might have handled it differently, it's more useful to look at your own life. By examining your own rationalizations and moral compromises, you can better understand the complexity and unpredictability of people's ethical and moral decisions. I faced a dilemma when Dave, the CEO of a company in Berkeley that designed custom automation equipment, invited me to lunch to talk about joining the company's board of directors. As we talked, some of the plans Dave had about the use of automation instead of actual humans in jobs pushed my buttons. It was a difficult spot. I didn't want to be associated with anything that would take away people's jobs, and yet I was tempted by the offer, which included substantial stock options. I was sure that if I told him about my objections, it would kill the deal. It was a moment of pressure, and I needed to give him an answer. I told him that I would not accept his offer. He asked me to explain my decision. After I detailed my objections, he assured me he shared my concerns and would not be doing the things I objected to. Did I really believe it? I wasn't sure. Automation is designed to take away human tasks, after all. Yet all it took was that little nudge to get me to set aside my conscience. I acquiesced and agreed to join the board. My experience on the board was quite positive on both technical and personal levels. Several years later, the company was sold to a large corporation, and my stocks brought me one of the largest single financial gains of my life. Looking back, I always remember how sure I was at that lunch that by voicing my objections I would kill the deal. What actually happened was quite the opposite. I learned two big lessons that day. First, I believed I could know how someone else would react, but you can't. You can never be sure what someone else is thinking. Second, I was sure I would resist temptation. Yet when push came to shove, I easily rationalized away my principles once someone gave me an excuse to do so. It gives me a lot of compassion for friends who, at the crucial moment, choose to drive the tractor. A classic study of anxiety over how one will act under pressure is described in Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage. This novel gives us a vivid psychological portrayal of a young soldier beset by the anxiety that under fire he will be overcome by fear. As the war proceeds, he exposes his cowardice and ultimately his heroism. Like this young soldier, regardless of our self-image, it is difficult to know beforehand how we will actually act under pressure. Research and statistics. When you make decisions based on the research, you can easily be led astray by researchers' biases, which can lead them to make false claims and exaggerations. I have spent most of my professional life publishing research papers, so I feel I know something about research. I understand scientific research processes and their limitations. Furthermore, as they say, some of my best friends are scientists. Some of them are even psychologists and behavioral scientists, and I have witnessed, and even been a subject in, a few of their experiments. Based on all these experiences, I feel that in studying human behavior, it is really hard to come up with categorical statements. There's a lot of potential for misinterpretation, exaggeration, and just bad science. So I am often put off when someone uses such phrases as, "Science shows," "The research shows," or "The fact is, there is science behind this." I wish that we did know all the things that are claimed. Although there is a lot of good, and even great, science, I do feel claims of scientific verification are at times exaggerated and unwarranted when it comes to human behavior. The overreach of science probably arose because of the many unsubstantiated claims and ridiculous belief systems being bandied about. To combat this fraud, exploitation, and just plain ignorance, a sort of scientific vigilantism has developed. For some people, nothing can be considered valid without the imprimatur of science. My main concern is that when we insist on claims of scientific veracity, we downgrade or even rule out important sources of personal wisdom that exist independent of formal experimental verification. Unfortunately, experimental verification is itself also a rather imperfect tool. I think it's important to understand that every time someone uses the word science or research, he is talking about the work not of some omnipotent beings with access to revealed truths, but of fallible people working in a currently accepted paradigm and socialized into a scientific family and job structure. What it comes down to is that it is hard to convincingly prove or disprove things experimentally unless they already fit into people's belief systems. Your turn. Don't try this. List as many of your core beliefs as possible, and then ask yourself what basis you have for each belief. My own experience is that, unsurprisingly, a large number of my core beliefs come from my parents, the social and physical environment I grew up in, and my various peer groups. The next question to ask is, which of your beliefs still serve you, and which have become dysfunctional and are best discarded? Even when the data is sound, like the fact that half of all marriages end in divorce, does that mean that you should give up the idea of getting married because it has too high a potential failure rate? Statistics can show you trends. They can't predict your life. Likewise, consider that the odds have always been against greatness. If one were to decide on a career path just by the odds of financial success, we would have no movie stars, authors, poets, or musicians. The odds of any one person becoming a professional, self-supporting musician are very low, and yet turn on the radio, and you can hear hundreds of them. The odds were against the Beatles, Elvis, and the Grateful Dead, too. They could have been scientific about the whole thing and chosen more reasonable career paths, and what a loss for the world that would have been. If you succeed, the odds are meaningless. Any path may have a 2% success rate, yet if you're in that 2%, there's a 100% chance of success for you. The long shots are often the most rewarding. The Gift of Failure. Oprah Winfrey was fired from her first job as a television anchor. That's a good thing. Can you imagine what she would have missed out on if she'd gotten comfortable as a reporter in Baltimore? Dr. Seuss's first book was rejected by dozens of publishers and saw the light of day only because a friend agreed to publish it himself. Thomas Edison failed numerous times when trying to produce a light bulb, so many times that he famously said, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." Almost without exception, people who have done great things have also experienced great failures. And in many cases, getting fired or a similar devastating failure turned out to be a gift that allowed them to ultimately find great success. As you now know, at the D School, one of the basic principles is a bias toward action. That is, it is better to start to do something and fail than it is to do nothing and wait for the correct path of action to appear. Failure is part of the result to expect if you have a bias toward action. The idea is not to be paralyzed in the face of uncertainty. If you do something and it works, great! If you do something and it fails, maybe even better. You do, you fail, and you learn. You do again, you fail again, and you learn some more. If you are mindful about what you have done, failure is a teacher. With a little luck, after enough failures, you will succeed. In many cases, this is a much better approach than a long, drawn-out investigation into the right way to proceed. Nobody wants to fail, and yet we all do. Don't be afraid of failure. It is part of the price you pay for action. There's no need to sweep it under the rug and pretend it doesn't exist. The most liberating way to acknowledge failure is to celebrate it. Let's look at circus clowns. When they unintentionally drop an item they are juggling, they often jump up with arms outstretched, a big smile, and a loud ta-da. My former colleague, Rolf Fasta, used to have participants in our workshop take the clown's ta-da bow when they messed up. It did wonders. It made it okay to show one's mistakes and not try to cover them up. The accepting repeated failure route, if used with an open mind, can lead to much better solutions than does a fear of failure. A system that punishes failures rather than accepting that they occur on the road to success squelches creativity. People tend to accept the notion that failure can be productive as an abstraction. Yet, unsurprisingly, in reality, they find it difficult to accept failure unless they're in an environment that supports this notion. In the D School, we have had a great deal of success in creating such an environment. It's incredible to watch graduate students free themselves from the thrall of an entire career based on the principle that it is bad or even catastrophic to make a mistake. The pressure disappears. They feel reborn, and they often produce amazing results. It's success, stupid. My 7th and 8th grade years are blank in my memory, save for the bottle cutter I built. That one experience stands out. I recall every detail of the project. I remember the fruit market where I found the crate to dismantle and use as a wood base. I recall the purchase of a 3-foot length of nichrome wire. This was the heart of the device. A thin wire made of nichrome has high electrical resistance and becomes red hot when electricity passes through it, as it does in toasters and hair dryers. When wrapped around a glass bottle, no plastic in those days, the red hot wire gets the glass hot enough to crack if the bottle is plunged into cold water. If the wire is thin enough and the wrap is tight enough, you get a perfect break, and the bottle splits into two perfect pieces, the neck and the base. I thought it was magical, although I have no recollection of needing to cut bottles for anything. The only teacher I can recall is Mr. Dill, the science teacher who inspired the project and who feigned mild annoyance when I came to him after class for advice. I also vividly recall discovering, the hard way, that I needed to have my own fuse in the device if I didn't want to blow the fuses in the entire apartment. It was a memorable experience because it was the first time I can remember really making something on my own. I discovered I could make something real in the world. It was a formative experience that increased my self-esteem and gave me self-efficacy. Although I didn't realize it at the time, that small success presaged a life of deriving great satisfaction from figuring out how to do things on my own and solving problems. I've noticed that similar early experiences have stayed with many of my colleagues. David Kelly talks about how, when he was young, he succeeded in taking the family piano apart. My friend Vic talks more about his youthful science project than the sophisticated robot designs that subsequently made him famous. Even habits, such as reading, are learned by building upon small successes. I recall how empowered I felt as a child after I read my first complete book. From that point on, I was a reader. Later, as I got busy with my professional life, I lost the reading habit. So when I started to teach my Design in Society course, I put readings into it, as much for my own sake as for that of the students. I asked them to read a book a week for 8 weeks, and that regular activity gets all of us used to making time in our lives for reading. I have regained the habit, and many students tell me how thankful they are to have it as an unexpected side benefit of my course. Success opens the door for increased self-esteem. If it comes early in life, it can do much to shape your future direction. If it does not come early, it can still be achieved. It's important to attempt different modalities and not remain stuck in one that does not nurture and fulfill you. Fear of failure often keeps us in an unsatisfied routine. Instead of daydreaming about change, reach out and attempt new things. Small steps, with accompanying successes, lead to major life transitions. Your turn. Did you have a youthful, formative experience of accomplishing something on your own? Think back to the essence of that experience. Looking at your current life, what would you do differently if you were not afraid of failing or looking bad? In the next week, attempt something new in one of these areas. At first, take a small step. Then, in each of the 3 subsequent weeks, take an additional step. If you trip, pick yourself up and keep moving forward. The main constructs of this chapter are easy to test in your own life. Be honest and notice the differences between your self-image and the ways you actually act. Notice the difference between intention and attention, between trying to do something and actually doing it. Finally, notice how the habit of acting on your dreams builds from direct experience and from overcoming the fear of failure. Watch your language. Chapter 6. Sincerity. If you can fake that, you've got it made. George Burns. The way we communicate with people has a significant effect on their opinions of us. It's not just about what we say, but how we say it. Becoming better communicators can heal relationships, lead to better job opportunities, and enable us to reach wider audiences with whatever messages we want to share. Language influences the way we see things. Public relations specialists and advertisers certainly know and exploit this, as do politicians, governments, and all sorts of spin artists. It has long been known that using different labels for the same thing will promote different behaviors. For our purposes, it is important to understand what we do to ourselves with our own choice of words and use of language. Once we are aware of our usage, we can adjust our language to be more in keeping with our true intentions and the existential situations we are describing. Yes, no. Let's start with a simple dichotomy. Yes and no. There are situations in which we say one thing and mean the other. Some cultures, for example, recognize specific situations where it is considered impolite to say no. In others, it is considered polite to say no when one means yes. For instance, in Iran, you're expected to refuse at first when a host offers you food and drink. Only after he pushes you to accept are you supposed to say yes. I often use yes and no in a simple exercise. I pair people and ask them to have a conversation where one person repeatedly says yes, and each time the other person answers with no. After some minutes, I ask them to reverse roles. The yes person now becomes the no person, and the no person becomes the yes person. Most people find it easier to say yes. A substantial number, however, report being more comfortable saying no, and very few report no difference. For me, the interest is in the dynamic between the two people. It can take many forms. For example, it can have the form of an argument, a simple sober conversation, a big joke, or even a courtship. The point is for the participants to experience the big difference between the lyrics and the music in a conversation. In this exercise, I wrote the lyrics. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And the participants got to write the music and even the choreography, what tone and body language they used when they delivered their yes or no. After they think about this exercise, people often find something in their choice of music that helps them reach greater self-understanding. And, but. The lyrics tend to dominate the music for the words and but. The existential situation almost always calls for the conjunction and, not but. Yet we often use but in place of and. This substitution is so common that it sounds correct. Unfortunately, it often has the effect of changing a neutral statement into a negative one. Let's take an example. I want to go to the movies, but I have work to do. The sentence uses the conjunction but to tie together two phrases. I want to go to the movies, and I have work to do. Let's assume that the existential situation is that they are both true. Then, in fact, the actual situation is represented by, I want to go to the movies, and I have work to do. Existentially, movies and work are not in opposition. The word but is okay in common usage, and it does not reflect the true situation. When you use the word but, you create a conflict, and sometimes a reason for yourself that does not really exist. With the word and, there is no issue. You might or might not choose to go to the movies or to work. The use of but closes off the conversation space, while and opens it up. Furthermore, what follows the but is often bullshit reasoning. In improvisation terms, but is blocking. It is to be avoided as much as possible. Where are you putting your buts? Whatever you're trying to achieve, notice where you're blocking yourself by shutting down the conversation with a but. Let's say your goal is to get a popular internship and it requires extensive travel. I want this internship, but I'm afraid of flying, you tell yourself. What your brain then hears is, oh well, c'est la vie, guess we're not doing this internship. When you open up the dialogue with, and I'm afraid of flying, your brain gets to consider how it can deal with both parts of the sentence. Maybe you'll see a therapist about it. Maybe you'll practice meditation. The problem is that if you only use and in conversation, you sound weird. I did an experiment years ago and went an entire weekend using and rather than but. Believe me, you don't want to do it. I often handle the situation when I find it prudent to say but out loud by simultaneously converting it to and internally. This works well, except when someone who has taken a workshop from me hears the but and shows how smart they are by publicly correcting me. I smile, and I hate it. Please don't be a smartass. Just fix yourself. If you want to fix your friends and family, just give them a copy of this book. It will be much better for your relationships. Your turn. To get the flavor of this, the next five times you use the word but, simply change it to and in your mind. Do this silently by repeating to yourself what you just said out loud with only this one word change. Notice how it feels. have to, want to. Next on our list of words to be used as little as possible is the phrase, I have to. The true situation is usually best described instead by, I want to. Rather than argue with people about this, I always have them do a simple exercise, one that works best with a partner. You compose a sentence that starts, I have to. Your partner repeats the sentence with, you want to, substitute.